Welcome to the session on design in nature. I'm Dominic Halsmer. I'm the moderator of this session. I'm also a professor of engineering at ORU here and the chair, program's chair for today's. I'm going to close that down. Thanks for the conference. We have four presentations scheduled for this session, and one of the presenters, A.J. Boulay, informed us that he had some emergency to attend to, but he would send his video, a video presentation in his lieu of his presentation. So we are going to attempt to play that in the second slot at 1:45. But for right now, John Voth, one of our engineering students, and myself are going to present Reframing Fine-Tuning in Terms of Engineered Affordances. So I've been teaching engineering for 23 years here at ORU, and the last 8 years or so I've been really fascinated with the idea that there's a role for engineering in this dialogue or conversation between science and theology. Actually, is a dialogue, but I'd like to turn it into a conversation where there's another participant, the field of engineering. And so what I see in the universe is ingenuity. Ingenuity is defined as skill or cleverness in devising or combining things in ways that provide solutions or value. And so one way to put this is the universe is made up of things that go bump in the night, right? Here's an example from the Astronomy Picture of the Day website of two galaxies that are colliding. And you might think, well, that's too bad because their structure is being deformed and they're being torn apart in one sense. But they're also, if you notice in the middle there, is an area of new star formation going on. And that's the theme that I see in the universe, is these collisions occurring between atoms, molecules, and things that produce things of value. These collisions are actually good. And we see that in our own lives, too, in interesting ways. And Esther Meek got me thinking about, you know, even husbands and wives collide, but it's a beautiful thing that can result from that kind of a collision. So I'm going to turn it over to John here, but I did want to give a short commercial for a book I'm working on, which explores the effectiveness of engineering within the science and theology dialogue to help us make sense of the universe, and it's called Hacking the Cosmos. But let me turn it over to John. I expect that to be out hopefully by the end of this year, or at least the manuscript to be finished by the end of this year. So let me turn it over now to John Voth.
All right. So the first step in our presentation is to define and explain fine-tuning. I'm sure it's something that all of you have heard about before, but just so we're on the same page, I'm going to give you a definition. Most of this information about fine-tuning comes from Alistair McGrath's book, A Fine-Tuned Universe. I love the definition that he gives here. He says that the heavily freighted vocabulary of fine-tuning is widely used to express the idea that the universe appears to have possessed certain qualities from the moment of its inception which were favorable to the production of intelligent life on Earth at this point in cosmic history, life capable of reflecting on the implications of its existence. So essentially what he's saying is that the universe appears to be just so specially designed that humans and other life and Earth is here at this moment in time, and that we're capable of learning something about this science. And I love that he also mentions, right after he gives this definition, a little disclaimer about fine-tuning. Says that fine-tuning is very, very interesting, it's very applicable, but at most it's a resonance. It's not definite proof of God. He says that resonance between theory and observation, it does not prove that theory is true, however it's highly suggestive. So he just gives that tone that that fine-tuning is something that should be looked at, but it's not definite proof for God. So I'm going to give you some specific examples of fine-tuning, starting with cosmological evidence. These are all pieces of information given by Martin Rees, who's an astronomer. And there are six interesting facts here. The first one is about the ratio of electromagnetic force to the ratio of the force of gravity. This has to do with the formation of atoms and molecules and elements, mostly in stars, and that this ratio is on a razor's edge. It needs to be exactly where it has to be in order for atoms to cohesively form together. The second one has to do with strong nuclear force, also responsible for holding atoms together. To give you a quantitative example of how specific these values are, is that strong nuclear force, which as I said is responsible for bonding atomic nuclei together, it has a value of 0.007. We've calculated it, and if there's a value, if we plug in the value of 0.006 or 0.008, it would prove the development of life impossible. It is exactly where it has to be. And this isn't the only coincidence like this. You'll see the theme. Number three is omega, which is a proportional, it's the proportion between the amount of matter in the universe. So the amount of dark matter and regular matter, normal energy and dark energy. And it has to do with the expansion of the universe, where we need just the correct proportion of dark matter and normal matter for the universe to expand correctly. If it was off, then the universe would either keep expanding into essentially emptiness, or a long time ago it would have expanded a little bit and then the gravity would have overwhelmed it and come back together. Similar to that, there's cosmic repulsion, which has to do with dark energy, and it is referred to as anti-gravity. It's a slight force that's everywhere that works against gravity, and it's so slight, but it is absolutely necessary. If it wasn't there, and it was just gravity by itself, then our universe a long time ago would have crunched back together. Also, we have Q, which is the ratio of the gravitational binding force to rest mass energy. And lastly, we have the number of spatial dimensions is obviously 3. If it was 2 or 1, although string theory suggests, 10 or 11, then life wouldn't really be possible. And beyond cosmological evidence for fine-tuning, there's also biological evidence. This is also covered by McGrath. So we have DNA and RNA, which is the code of life. It's like a computer code, but it is specific and unique to each individual. Just its complexity alone tells of a creator. It almost tells of an engineer, of a sculptor almost, that sits down and forms this beautiful code of who we are. And its complexity alone, like I said, it tells of a creator, but also the evolutionary argument that has to happen, that this somehow evolved, this gradually came to be. It's hard to swallow that this thing, DNA, just came to be. Also, we have the production of carbon and oxygen. As we know, most elements were produced in the stars, in the center of stars, and these elements were produced in precisely the correct proportion to each other to be used in life. This is because of the energy level of the nuclei of oxygen and carbon. They're found to be exactly 7.65 and 7.12. And this is interesting because they are found to be these values for no real reason, that we can't really guess why they are as they are, but they are and it works. A good quote by Fred Hoyle, another astronomer, says, "If you wanted to produce carbon and oxygen in roughly equal quantities by stellar nucleosynthesis, your fixing would have to be just where these levels are to actually found it to be." Some more biological evidence is about carbon. It's very not abundant on the Earth's surface. It takes up 0.032%. But, as we all know, it's critically important and it's found all over organic chemistry. And it is very interesting that it's hard to believe that evolution would choose such a rare molecule, such a rare element, to be so necessary in molecular organic chemistry. On that same note is phosphate. Phosphate is also extremely rare, but it's absolutely crucial in ATP and other molecules in organic chemistry. And there's countless other elements that are trace elements that are absolutely necessary, but very inabundant, and they just are in us. So we've looked at cosmology, we've looked at biology, and you can narrow the scope down even further to just study one molecule, which is water. As we all know, water is completely fundamental to Earth. It is in chemistry, biology, geology, so many sciences. And water is kind of a freakish chemical. It is very unique and it plays its role very, very necessarily. So here are some fine-tuning evidence about water. First of all, the density of the liquid water doesn't rapidly change with temperature. Water is a liquid over most of Earth's surface. Ice floats on water, contrary to most solids and liquids, so the density of the solid water is less than the density of liquid water, which is rare. Water takes less heat to evaporate than most liquids. It has unusually high specific heat capacity, thermal conductivity, and surface tension. It has an exceptional capacity for stabilizing polar and ionic species in solution because of its very high dielectric constant. In simpler terms, it's an excellent solvent. And then if hydrogen bonds were 15% weaker, or the bond angle of water was 90 degrees instead of its observed 104.5, then water really wouldn't exist as a chemical. The three-dimensional network of hydrogen bonds, which give water its unique solvation properties, would collapse. So in a form of conclusion of this fine-tuning evidence, we notice that the sciences aren't, they're not completely distinct from each other, they are nested. So when we look at biology, when we break it down, we realize biology is really governed by the laws of chemistry. And it works to restrict evolution, and it works to argue the case of a fine-tuned universe. Evolution can only fine-tune itself because of the predetermined properties of chemical elements. But then we look at chemistry and we say we can break that down further, that chemistry is really governed by these weird quantum mechanical parameters. And these parameters, as far as we know, they just kind of are. It's hard to find a cause or an effect for them. It's hard to really explain them other than we can just find values for them, and they seem to be exactly where they have to be. So therefore, we see that these almost predetermined or predestined, maybe, quantum mechanical parameters, they control the possibilities of biology. And all of this supports the claim of a finely tuned universe.
Thank you, John. Related to the chemistry fine tuning is a work that I just realized is coming out next year, a book by Ben McFarland at Seattle Pacific University that talks about a world from dust, how the periodic table shaped life. So we're discovering now, recent research has shown that not only are the constants of physics and the initial conditions of the universe, but even the laws of nature seem to be tuned or set in such a way as to promote or constrain the production and sustenance of life. And so he is, he's also one of the grantees from the BioLogos project, and it's coming, this book is coming out in the winter through Oxford University Press. Looks really interesting. Along with this is one of the greatest philosophers that's dealing with the fine-tuning work right now is at Messiah College, Robin Collins. And most recently, he's got a paper out that talks about how the fine-tuning appears also to be engineered in such a way as to allow for discovery of the universe. Fine-tune for discovery is his idea. So if you're interested in that, you can go to Robin Collins' website and check out his work on fine-tuning for discovery. Jim Stump has recently reviewed a book that I really need to get my hands on. I just found out about it a few days ago. It's called An Introduction to Design Arguments by Benjamin Janssen. But in reviewing this book, Jim Stump says, none of these design arguments reaches the level of being entirely compelling. Janssen thinks the fine-tuning arguments, however, have the most going for them. So the fine-tuning arguments are seen as being some of the most powerful arguments for theism. But ultimately, their success depends on abstruse metaphysical arguments about the nature of law, explanation, and possible worlds about which there is no consensus. So they're not fully, completely compelling. Now, let me introduce or bring us back to about 60 years ago, when C.P. Snow wrote about this challenge that the science and the humanities were having with each other. They were not talking to each other. They talked two different languages, and there was this resulted in difficulty in solving some of the world's problems and in answering some of the big questions, I think. So I am suggesting that engineering might make an entrance here into the conversation between science and the humanities and perhaps bring some helpful ideas from the field of engineering. That's my proposal. And specifically, I want to explore the idea that we see ingenuity in nature. That's skill or cleverness at devising or combining. I teach machine design, and if you explore the definition of a machine, it's simply elements arranged to transmit motion or energy. And I see this in the universe. I know it may be thought archaic to suggest that the universe is a type of machine, but we see that motion and energy are produced in the creation event, the Big Bang, and that they seem to be arranged in such a way as that these collisions result in value, complexity, and things like human beings. Even evolution requires fine-tuned laws and physical constants to reach the point that it has. Fine-tuning can be reframed then in terms of a new term that I'm introducing here. Well, I'm not introducing it. This was an idea that was brought out in psychology in the 1950s by James Gibson. The phrase is affordance. And it's the idea that relationships result in a capability or an ability. It's a very simple concept. The chair you're in right now affords sitting. It also affords stacking and mobility. A cell phone affords 100 things that we never thought possible just a few years ago. But when you have a complex system, you can have part-to-part affordances, like two gears that mesh. It actually results in a part-to-part affordance, because one gear affords something to the other gear, basically torque and speed requirements, that ultimately then provides something to an end user. But you see, these kinds of affordances can be nested in both space and time. And so this is, again, what we see in the universe. For example, atoms afford combinations to produce molecules. Molecules like carbon dioxide and water afford biochemistry. Biochemistry affords biology and living organisms. When you look at this in terms of affordances, you see much nesting. Now, that's what engineers do. Engineers are not so much the creators of devices, but they use relationships to provide affordances for their customers. Things of value, abilities, valuable abilities and capabilities. And so when you look at nature and you see these nested affordances, it's powerful evidence for an engineered universe or an engineering influence or an intentionality behind the universe. Jonathan Myers brought this out in his work as a researcher in engineering at Clemson University. The book is entitled Affordance-Based Design. And an article recently in the Mechanical Engineering magazine, Rethinking Design Theory, he says, he proposes the concept of affordance, what a system provides to an end user or to another part of the system, as an underlying and unifying principle in the science of product design and reverse engineering. So this got me thinking about science as reverse engineering, in particular, affordance-based reverse engineering, where you dissect something to explore what are the affordances that are inherent in this system. Now, an affordance is a metaphysically neutral concept. I mean, if you say the human brain is for thinking, that already puts a teleological spin on it, right? Because you're implying purpose. But if you say that the human brain affords thinking, that's actually neutral. It's simply a statement of what the brain is able to do, and we recognize that it can do that. It doesn't put any inherent teleological in that. But what I'm suggesting is when you look at the universe and see all of these affordances kind of pointing towards the same idea, that there's an engineering influence behind the universe, then at least a skeptic should entertain the hypothesis of an engineered universe and perhaps explore that hypothesis. Seems reasonable to me. What are the advantages? Well, like I said, engineers design relationships, not artifacts. And it points three ways. Now I'm talking about this triad that I talked about with Esther Meek in my question this morning after her plenary. The big picture of design is actually three things. The thing which is designed, the artifact, the user of that artifact, and then the original engineer who designed the artifact. It brings function and human implications together. Relationship becomes important. Describes the basic reason that we do engineering. It facilitates the exploration of motive and intent. It ties the artifact to its reason for being. It allows for optimization in terms of maximizing positive affordances and minimizing negative affordances. It can also serve to quantify a system, how well does it afford something, and suggest a natural metric then for engineering. Other fields of study are actually using this idea of affordances. Here's a literary professor, Carolyn Levine at University of Wisconsin-Madison, where she's the chair, writing about forms in literature and how these forms affect culture and politics. Basically, colliding forms generate complex and unpredictable social landscapes that challenge and unsettle conventional analytic models, she writes. Borrowing the concept of affordances from design theory, this book investigates the specific ways that four major forms, wholes, rhythms, hierarchies, and networks, have structured culture, politics, and scholarly knowledge. Now, I'm fascinated with the parallel here that we see in nature as a book. And this has already been discussed with other speakers in this conference. If nature is a book that communicates to us with signs, there's a lot of parallels with the work that Caroline Levine is doing here in her look at how literal books, deal with these forms to produce affordances in their work. John Sanders writes in this book, Perspectives on Embodiment, I propose that affordances can be taken as fundamental ontological entities, indeed as being ontologically prior to objects and events. Affordances can be thought of as being in the mind of God before he created objects, is what this idea of a first philosophy that John Sanders is talking about here. While ontology must be relativized to what different observers can do in terms of affordances, this is no mere matter of what the observer thinks or believes. It is a function of what the observer can do. And this may be as objective a matter as anyone can hope. So he argues that affordances are a good place to start in terms of an objective stance. Don Norman, in his book, The Design of Everyday Things, says affordances provide strong clues as to the operations of things. And he also introduces a new term called signifiers. Signifiers indicate signifiers are indicators that communicate appropriate behavior, provide valuable clues as to the nature of the world. Signifiers tell us how to use the affordances we have. If life is an affordance in the universe, then I can see God giving us a sense of right and wrong as an important signifier then in how to use that life in a positive way. Here's the big picture of design that I was talking about. As you see, the designer or engineer, the artifact, that which is engineered, and the user, the end user. Now, there's some interesting overlap here, obviously, between the artifact and the user, because human beings not only are kind of the users of the universe, but we are part of the universe, so that makes it challenging. But in another sense, we're also not the only end users, but God has created us for his purposes, so in the end, he's an end user of this system. So there's some challenges to applying this kind of approach, but I think it's fruitful. And affordances capture important interactions then within the designer artifact user system in this big picture of product design. And actually, one can introduce a fourth entity and make it even more complex, where you have the designer, artifact, and user of the artifact, but also the investigator, or that the person who is more than just a user, but is an explorer who wants to investigate or reverse engineer the system and discover truth. And we've done that in regard to trying to answer some of the problem of evil and suffering in the world by suggesting that there, when you do a reverse engineering project, you always have to look and ask yourself the question, has there been some corruption or damage or wear and tear on the system that I'm studying? Or is it a pristine model? In the case of humanity, in the Christian theology, we say, obviously there has been some corruption in the system. So I think there's some value here for theodicy as well. Because brokenness, we know, we have clues that it can afford us certain things, like significant opportunities to show compassion and love. This is from the work of Richard Swinburne at Oxford University in his book, The Existence of God. To show compassion and kindness, to grow strong and useful, to learn truth and humility. Augustine said God thought it better to draw good out of evil rather than that no evil would exist at all. But still, this is a mystery to us. But it seems to me God is the master of the beneversal. He makes the devil work for him. Right? This is what good engineers. This is a documented aspect of good engineering, is making the devil work for you. When something goes wrong, turn it around and cause it to work for good. It was good for me to be afflicted so that I might learn your decrees. The law from your mouth is more precious to me than thousands of pieces of silver and gold. And you know what the high technology was in the days when Israel was forming? It was the iron smelting furnace. And this is a rich picture of God revealing his nature as one who refines his people in the fires of adversity. This is a picture of God as a process engineer, one who's intimately involved, because if you study iron smelting in that time, you know the blacksmith was intimately involved in making sure the temperatures were just right and everything was according to what it needed to be in order to produce the appropriate product. But the other thing that you see in common among these three verses right here is not just the iron smelting furnace, but the clues as to why God is doing this. It's for relationship, that we would be his people and he would be our God. So keep that in mind next time you're going through the furnace. And you mentioned Ernst von Balthasar, and I love this quote from him. Love makes us free if it is selfless. And if it is selfless, it is selfless if it is ready to sacrifice pleasure, advantage, and independence for the sake of the beloved. And since no earthly love is initially perfect, it must go through these purifications. Moments and times must come when love is tested through sacrifice, when it becomes clear whether the enthusiasm of the first encounter was love at all, when the naive first love, if it really was love, is refined and deepened in the fire of renunciation. Somehow we must have opportunity to renounce evil. And that's only possible in our universe as it is. In summary then, fine-tuning evidence offers strong but not completely compelling elements in the cumulative case for theism. Reconsidering fine-tuning as nested affordances offers an objective philosophical starting point, a first philosophy according to Sanders. Affordance-based reverse engineering of natural systems facilitates the exploration of vital relationships and illuminates adversity in our world. And this relational theory of design then resonates with Judeo-Christian idea of fall and redemption. Science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind. But the blind and lame came to Jesus at the temple and he healed them. So, any questions? Just a couple minutes for questions. Bill?
I'll throw out a comment and then a question. If you go back a slide to the, right there, number one, fine-tuning offers strong but not completely compelling elements in the case of theism. And you start out with McGrath's comment. I guess the thing I have seen, and maybe this is symptomatic of the dysfunction in our culture, our way of thinking. From my study of philosophy of science, there is no such thing as a scientific proof. And then probably I could go all the way, but there is no such thing as proof in anything anywhere. So why, I guess the thing is, why all these warnings and fears about using something because it doesn't prove it all the way?
I think it's important because we are communicating so often to folks that are not in the scientific community. And so it sounds kind of redundant and obvious, maybe to state it in this room.
Yeah.
But I'm giving talks in churches and schools all over Tulsa lately, and that's one of the points I want to drive home. So maybe it's obvious in here, but a lot of people, they think that we should be trying to prove God's existence in a compelling line by line kind of way, and I don't think that's the way God has engineered the universe to work.
Well, I think the attempt to remove every last trace of faith gets you in big trouble.
Yes.
And that's, in terms of teaching engineering students, keeping that element of faith in what is offered generally as a science, there's a science of design, well, that kind of removes humanity from the process and removes the hand of God in what you're doing.
So. Right. Thank you for the comment. Greg?
You flipped right by a comment as a geologist. You said science is reverse engineering. But you just flipped right through that. That's a pretty big comment.
Yeah, I know. And it's a controversial statement.
I really like it, though. And then you also made one other comment. You said engineers design relationships, not artifacts. But for years you've been saying God is an engineer. But when I look at Genesis 1, I look at him creating systems. But systems are all about relationships.
Right, right.
Which means God is creating relationships, not artifacts.
Yeah.
And we make the mistake of interpreting Genesis 1 as making the moon and the sun in day 4, not designing a system of stable time, i.e. relationships between the sun and the moon.
Right, right.
How do we communicate those systems and relationships to the general public that thinks in terms of artifacts?
Right. Actually, I introduced a new term in yesterday's Tulsa World interview, that God is a cosmoneer, because I was hoping to distinguish him from engineer. Because when you say God's an engineer, I think people think, oh no, you're trying to make him like us. But obviously his ways are beyond our ways. If an engineer is a maker of engines and a cosmoneer is a maker of cosmoses, I don't know if that helps any. But yeah, it's a different way of thinking about what an engineer does, I think might be helpful. All right, let's go in the back, John.
Yeah, I like kind of your idea of sort of reverse engineering suffering, but I'm not convinced that's the same thing as theodicy. I think if we understand like a purpose in suffering, then what we do is we explain the evil away, we don't explain evil. So I'm wondering, would you defend that as theodicy, or would you say what you're doing is kind of a more like a pastoral practice?
I'm hoping that this can contribute to a helpful understanding of evil and suffering. You can determine whether it counts as theodicy or not.
Okay.
Theologians can determine, but I think it's useful to take a multidisciplinary approach at these things.
No, I think the metaphor is very...
I don't know if you noticed the entrance that was made by the engineering was Kramer coming through the door of Seinfeld's apartment, so it may be kind of klutzy at first as we enter this conversation, but please cut us some slack.
Well, there are at least things called secular theodicies, too, the taking of things that are bad or problems and turning them into good things. So that's sort of what engineers do.
Right.
In a sense there, too, apart from any religious connotations.